So, hello Professor, thank you for speaking with me. You came to Lithuania this month and it was the first time, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
What brought you to this region? Any particular reason?
Well, I'm interested in seeing as much of the world as I can. We had the opportunity to do a European tour. I very much enjoyed touring through Eastern Europe the times I've done it. And so we had been to Lithuania and the opportunity opened up. And so that was the generality of the reason. So, you know, when you plan a tour, there's a variety of considerations that go into it. The theater has to be available. It has to be of the right size. And then it has to be available when you're near so that you can sequence it. And so there's lots of considerations for which routes, you know, which countries might be taken. And I indicated to my agents as well that, you know, I would like to spend more time in Eastern Europe. The reason for that was that I suspect that Eastern Europe, and this would include the Baltic states too, has a key role to play in the reversal of this trend towards the more Marxist end of the cultural wars that are presently raging, because you guys had Marxism for 7 decades and you haven't forgotten, whereas we're too foolish in the West to have any idea about what that means. And so these ideas that virtually destroyed you are still attractive to people here, but they're not that attractive to people in Eastern Europe, the Baltic states, not even to people on the left. So, you know, I can see, and I see that Eastern Europe and the Baltic states have had some success in resisting some of the ideas that have made more inroad in the West. So,
you were kind of the first person to introduce to the mass media a term of cultural Marxism, at least give it the biggest stage so far.
Yeah.
And it is still not widely accepted. There are many people contesting the notion that there is such a thing cultural Marxism. So what is that?
Well, the Marxist view of the world, which is rooted in an older resentment, I would say, is that there's the economic oppressors, that'd be the capitalists, let's say, and then there's the economic oppressed, and that would be the proletariat, the working class, the much-vaunted working class that the intellectuals hypothetically support, which they never do, by the way, not in actuality. So there's a dichotomy built into Marxism, which is basically a variant of the oppressor versus oppressed narrative. And what happened in the 1970s when it became ethically inappropriate to be a Marxist, even in France, is that Marxism just mutated it. It mutated into a meta-Marxism. It's, I suppose, cultural Marxism is one way of putting it, where the oppressor-oppressed narrative was expanded to include all possible categories. And so it expanded into the sexual domain, it expanded into the ethnic domain, it expanded into gender, and so people are divided into their different potential classifications and then further subdivided into oppressor and oppressed, and then morality becomes nothing but supporting the hypothetically oppressed against the hypothetical oppressor. And so, you know, and some of that was influenced, well, definitely by Marxism, because most of the postmodernists who were at the bottom of the emergence of these ideas were Marxists, and they said they were Marxists. So the idea that this isn't real is, it's like, Foucault was a Marxist, Derrida was a Marxist, Sartre was a Marxist. Now, I don't think Sartre is directly to blame for postmodernism, but like most French intellectuals of his time, he was a Marxist. It's like, this is not a secret. All you have to do is go read the writings of the people who are being worshipped now, Foucault in particular. Wow, I'm not inventing this, and it isn't a term I invented. I mean, cultural Marxism was an idea that had been kicking around for a long time. I don't think it's such a great term, really. I don't know if we have a better one. You know, and I've been criticized. Well, Peterson doesn't understand the difference between postmodernism, which, you know, specifies the absence of all overarching meta-narratives, and Marxism, because Marxism is a meta-narrative. It's like, that might be true, but it doesn't have anything to do with the fact that
they work hand in hand.
Well, the postmodernists who said there was no meta-narrative jumped into the Marxist camp anyways. They said, well, there's no meta-narrative except that of power. It's like, that's so... I don't think there's a more dangerous proposition than that. Because, first of all, look, we're sitting here having this discussion. If it's If it's me against you, which is what it is, if it's just power, if you either gain from this or I do, and it's zero sum, we are always enemies. Like, maybe you're my friend, well, our interests align. But as soon as they diverge, there's nothing but enmity. And I think the people who push that viewpoint, that's what they want. They want to use power, and they want a justification for it. And one of the things they say is, well, everything's about power. It's like, yeah, no, wrong. Like, fundamentally wrong. Couldn't be more wrong. It's anti-truth. Friendship isn't about power. Love isn't about power. The love you have for your children isn't about power unless you're a tyrant. It's not a tenable proposition, to say the least. And it's morally suspect, to say the least. And the idea that there's no such thing as cultural Marxism, it's like, you can bandy about your words all you like, but the notion that power is at the root of everything and that you can be moral by taking the side of the oppressed, that's the universal anti-Western narrative, and it's everywhere, and it's destroyed the universities. So, yeah, people don't want to believe it. That's, you know, that's up to them.
Traditionally minded people, at least in our region, used to think that the problem is liberalism.
Yeah.
And now we talk about Marxism.
Yeah.
And that confuses them. So how do we recognize Marxism in practice? It's quotas, it's hate speech. How do we recognize
Marxism always divides people up into groups. As soon as you see that, as soon as you're dealing with someone who proclaims that the core of identity is some group affiliation, doesn't matter what it is, ethnicity, gender, sex, race, socioeconomic class, it's those ideas. The ideas that possess them have essentially been derived from the Marxist presuppositions. The liberals, the classic liberals, tend to concentrate more on the individual, the atomized and isolated individual. They tend to see the individual as constrained by the state, by all social relationships. It's the individual striving to be free, to gratify to pursue their own rational self-interest, which is a stupid idea because our self-interest isn't precisely rational. The liberals concentrate on the individual. And I would prefer that to Marxism, like flat, hands down. But the problem with the liberal viewpoint, taken to the extreme, is that you end up in this atomized, you end up with this deracinated, atomized individuality as the core of identity, and it just doesn't work because identity cannot be found within the individual because you exist in relationship. So if you only stress the individual and you strip away the relationships, you leave with the individual virtually with nothing, maybe with their hedonism. And that's why there's an alliance between liberalism and the hedonists, because liberalism will collapse into hedonism. And that's just not helpful. No, it's not sustainable. Everyone knows that. You can't just gratify your whims. And the liberals would say, like the classic liberals, is like, well, you have your set of whims, let's say, and I have mine, and we can find a balance between them, and your right to your whims ends where my right begins, right? And that's pretty much the whole definition of the state, but that's foolish. It's foolish because the state is a hierarchy of relationships. That's a much more sophisticated conceptualization. The state is marriage. The state is marriage and family. The state is marriage, family, and local community, and then town, and then province or state, and then country, and then whatever contains that. And identity is all of those at once operating in something like harmony. And, if you're in a marriage, you're just as much a husband as you are an individual, and maybe even more so. And if you have children, you're more a father than you are an individual, or you should be. Or your individuality, this is what Bishop Barron was pointing to, your individuality finds its fuller expression in the element of your being that's making itself manifest as husband and father. That makes you more, not less. That's not a restriction. That's what Barron was trying to point out today. It's like, no, that's an elaboration of your identity. Part of the reason the young people are so desperate to insist that they define their own identity is because everything else has been stripped away from them. Well, the family is just a patriarchal institution. You shouldn't have children. And business is nothing but the predations of capitalism. And, it's just one thing after another is demolished. It leaves them with nothing.
Deconstruction.
Yeah. Yes, deconstruction. Yeah. Well, and the thing is, the deconstruction doesn't go all the way to the bottom because the deconstructionists themselves end they never deconstruct their own hedonistic whims. You know, this is the thing that's so strange about an atomized individuality. It's like, well, I get to do whatever I want. Okay, what is the I that you're talking about? Is the I now your wants and your immediate wants? So that's what you're identifying with, and you think that's you. You're going to identify, what are you going to, you're in a rage. So now you're nothing but your rage. Is that the theory here? Or maybe you're nothing but your sexual desire. Or you're nothing but your fear. You're not free. And why is that you? Why is that you? By definition. It's complete insanity. And if you adopt the hypothesis that that is you, you will be. You will have the kind of insanity that makes you completely intolerable to yourself and absolutely unable to get along with anyone. So you can't get along with someone who says, I get to do whatever I want whenever I want to do it. Like, no one wants to be around someone like that, you know? You want someone who, at least, optimally, you want someone who treats you better than you treat yourself. That'd be a hell of a good thing to encounter. You know, optimally, that's what you'd want. So, you know, and you kind of strive towards that in a marriage, because if you have any sense and you love your partner, and this is the same with the relationship you have with your children, it's very frequently the case that parents will love their children more than they love themselves. Now, maybe it shouldn't be that way, you know, maybe they should have more regard for themselves, but at least they find a higher order of being in the love that they have for children. One of the things I saw that was so remarkable when I had little kids is that, you know, even the roughest guys on the street, you know, broken people. You know, I walked into a bank one day. There was this drunken guy, street guy, you know, in the corner of the, by the vending, by the automatic teller, you know. And I brought in my, I think it was my son. And my son's a real nice kid. He was only about three, a very innocent, you know, happy kid. And the guy just crumbled and hid himself. He was so ashamed. And, you know, that's almost everyone is their better self around children. You know, you have to be one bent puppy to not have your better part come out when you see little kids. You know, there are people like that, but thank God they're not that common. And so we find our better self in the service to others, clearly, clearly. We even know this technically. So there's no difference between thinking about yourself and being miserable, technically. If you do statistical analysis and you look at the relationship between emotion and cognition, One of the best signifiers of misery is self-consciousness. They're the same thing. So as long as you're obsessed with what you want, you will be utterly miserable. So, you know, where kids are talking school all the time now. Well, you know, who is it? Who is the state? Who, you know, is there any authority that should be allowed to regulate your sexual conduct? No, it's just me. It's like, fine. If it's just you, you're doomed. You're done. It's not a good mode of being. And that's, you know, that's part of the manner in which liberalism becomes decadent, because it strips the individual of the community relationship. And you can't do that. We're so social that you can punish psychopaths by putting them in isolation. Right, so you take the worst people, the most antisocial people, the people who rely on power more than anyone else, and you want to punish them, you make them be alone. Right, that's how social people are. So the idea that we're autonomous individuals, you know, that's just, there's nothing about that that's true. We can be, imagine the state is extremely well set up, you know, so that the traditional relationships are thriving, the family's intact, the local community's intact, everything's working. You could be free, you could be an autonomous individual within that, right? But that means all those other things are working. And we almost did that, you know, like, it's even now we've got most of that, you know, in a city like Amsterdam, Montreal, you can walk around at 3 a.m, you're perfectly safe, you can pretty much do what you want, go what you want, but God, man, a lot of work went into that. It's very unlikely. You know, I lived in Montreal, and women can walk around at 3 a.m. in the roughest neighborhoods, really no problem. It takes a lot of social organization to provide people that much freedom. You know, it's very unlikely. And the liberals took that for granted. Or they said, well, you know, all the social relations were nothing but restriction. That's what Rousseau would think. You know, man is innately good. and it's only society that corrupts them. It's like, yeah, yeah.
You gave me a lot here. You were the one who called pronoun laws totalitarian.
Yeah.
And that was also quite a shock for many people.
Yes.
How can we call things, practices, laws totalitarian in democratic societies? What's totalitarian about that law? About...
Well, a constitutional democracy, there's limits on what the majority can do. They can't transgress against your intrinsic right. And the most intrinsic of the intrinsic rights, I think it's even above right to life, is right to speech, right to freedom of speech. And why? Well, it's not so you can just shoot off your mouth and say whatever you want to say. It's because you can't, no one can think otherwise. There's no difference between freedom of speech and thought. They're the same thing. We're thinking right now, you and I, having this conversation. If I'm not free to speak, I'm not free to think. And if your citizens aren't free to think, your society will die. Because thought is the substitute for death. We think so we don't die. So as soon as the government steps on freedom of speech, it's like, nope, you've overreached your boundaries. That, you know, that's part of the idea that the government has to exist within a domain of intrinsic rights. Well, why? It's not because the state grants you your bloody rights. It's because the state itself can't exist. The state will not maintain itself if it's composed of citizens who are forbidden to think. Like, it'll just ossify and collapse, just like you will if you stop thinking. So when my government said, here's words you have to say, it's like, no, no. Wrong. I'm way more afraid of the consequences of being unable to think freely than I am of whatever idiot punishment you half-witted dimwits can come up with. It's like, what are you going to threaten me with? You know, loss of my job? I don't care. I'd lose my job in a second if it was that or my tongue. I can get another job. I can get another job. I can't get another tongue. So, no, no way. And I was right about that, too. I told the goddamn Senate back in 2016 in Canada that their idiot legislation would produce a psychological epidemic. I told them that straight out and that it would affect young women. I knew it because I knew the literature. And that's exactly what's happened. So I don't regret that for a second. Bloody Trudeau.
In a sense, it changed the world. We are here because
yeah,
of that.
Yeah, right. Isn't that so strange?
It started things.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and everyone said to me, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. Like, why? What do you have against trans people? It's like, I don't care. What's my attitude towards trans people? It's something like, look, I'd rather you didn't, but if you're an adult, you can go to hell in a handbasket any way you choose. Right? That's your issue. I think it's a dreadful error, and I can't imagine how that's going to work out for you. And I'd rather it didn't happen, but, you know, in that sense, I'm a liberal. It's like...
You are.
Well, in that sense, it's like, adults, you have to provide... Adults have to be not allowed. Adults, you can't tread on the domain of freedom. And so that means people have to be free to make dreadful mistakes. And, you know, transformation, the probability that that's going to be a dreadful mistake is like, it's certain as far as I'm concerned, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not because I'm prejudiced. Jesus, I suspect that I've dealt with a broader range of people than like 99.9% of anybody you'll ever meet. I had all sorts of people in my clinical practice, like a very wide range of people. So it's not prejudice, it's sympathy. You know, these trans kids would come up, trans kids, and, well, you're interfering with us, like, and you're interfering with us. Like, no, you have no idea what you're doing is going to do to you. You have no idea. And I know what it'll do to you. It's like, I'm not your friend by hope. I'm not your enemy because I oppose the way you're destroying yourself. That's not an enemy. You're hurting my feelings. It's like, well, you're destroying your body permanently. You're paying butchers to do it, right? Yeah. The person who opposes that is your friend, even when you're not being your friend. So, brutal.
You mentioned that post-Soviet countries, Central Europe, has experience of Marxism in practice, and now in the wake of Marxism again that we talked about here, do you see like this region, peoples, nations in this region has like some mission, duty to talk about it to the world?
Definitely. And I can see that when I travel through Eastern Europe. I've traveled through Eastern Europe pretty extensively. I mean, people there are perturbed about the susceptibility of the privileged, rich West to these foolish, moralistic ideas. But you guys have the experience with this, you know? And so I think there's more resistance in Eastern Europe. That's what I've observed. Hungary is a good case in point, so is Poland. You know, and Hungary has been pilloried completely everywhere in the West. I mean, I've got in trouble just because I've gone to Hungary, you know, and talked to officials there. You're talking to the fascists. It's like, well, you know, they don't look as much like fascists to me as you look like communists to me. And maybe I'm wrong, but yeah, but I don't think so. Now, you know, I know that, you know, there's still plenty of corruption in Eastern European countries, even by Western European standards. And so I'm sure that in Hungary, for example, there's no shortage of corruption, but that doesn't mean that what the Hungarian government is doing is essentially fascist. And it certainly doesn't mean that just because the Hungarians aren't fond of idiot Western communists. So, no. And I really like the president of Hungary. I think she's deadly. I really like her family policy too. I think she got that exactly right. That's a major step forward. So I think the Eastern European countries have a real important role to play, you know, because they could be the place where Western civilization makes its real stand. So, and I think that's happening to some degree. So more power to them as far as I'm concerned.
Can we say that ARC is meant to help Western civilization make its stand?
Well, I think, I would hope is that ARC is here to make civilization make its stand, you know, because it's funny when we talk about Western civilization, it's like, let's say the Western civilization that we're talking about is Judeo-Christian. Well, why? In what way is it Western? Mm-hmm. Certainly not European. You know, it's Middle Eastern. It's even African to some degree, North Africa. Is that Western civilization? I don't think so. Civilization, you know, and then you might say, well, what about the Hindus and what about the Confucianists? And, well, look, there's variants of civilization, you know. Does the civilization that obtains in the West now, derived from the Judeo-Christian tradition, have advantages that those other civilizations lack? Yes, I think they do. I mean, look at China, you know, it's quite the mess.
How submissive they are.
Well, they don't have a tradition of their societies aren't based on the proposition that each person, we might say the explicit proposition that each person is made in the image of God. Right? And I think that's true. I think that proposition is true. I think it's true in that if you accept that proposition and you act it out, there isn't anything you can do that would set your life in more order than that. If you can act that out, everything will lay itself out for you. And you know that because, look, if you're married to someone and you treat them like a divine locus of consciousness, well, they're going to like you. They're going to be in love with you, right? You're going to treat them maybe better than they treat themselves. If you treat everyone that you come into contact with that realization in mind, everything will open up for you. And so in that sense, it's self-evidently true. And if you do the reverse, which is something like the power game we discussed earlier, you know, I'll just reduce you to whatever I can get from you. Well, maybe I can fool you once, you know, maybe I can steal what you have, but it's not going to work if you're interacting with me twice or three times, you know, and then I'll turn you from a potential friend into an enemy. You collect 100 enemies, see what your life is like, or even one. You know, you make an enemy at your peril, especially a real enemy, because a real enemy will light himself on fire to singe you. You don't need many people like that around before you're in hell. And so, you know, how do you get out of hell? Treat people like they're made in the image of God. That's there's no more practical advice than that. So
I think that's a good ending.